Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Carrie Curtis, a member of the club's Board of Governors and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my big pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Francis Moore LaPaix. To give Francis the introduction she deserves would take longer than we have, but suffice it to say that Francis is the author of 18 books, including the 3 million copy Diet for a Small Planet. She is the co-founder of three organizations, including Food First, the Institute for Food and Development Policy, and most recently the Small Planet Institute, a collaborative network for research and popular education seeking to bring democracy to life, which she leads with her daughter, Anna LaPaix. And Francis and Anna spoke here a year and a half ago or something like that. Francis and her daughter have also co-founded the Small Planet Fund, which channels resources to democratic movements worldwide. A few years ago, Francis received the Right Livelihood Award, which is sometimes referred to as the Alternative Nobel. She is here to speak about her newest book, and there's a quote from Jane Goodall about this book. Powerful and inspiring, EcoMind will open your eyes and change your thinking. I want everyone to read it. And I'll let you know that I read it, and I think it is wonderful as well. Without further ado, please welcome Francis Moore LaPaix.
Thank you. Thank you, Carrie. I'm delighted to be here and see some dear old friends and some new friends and be back in my old stomping ground. You know, it was 40 years ago this month that Diet for a Small Planet was published, written across the bay in Cypress Point Road in Point Richmond. And here I am again. And I just wanted to say this photograph was taken by my daughter in India on a trip that changed our lives. We wrote a book together called Hope's Edge, and that was, I could tell you a lot about that photograph, but I just wanted you to know that it has a special meaning to me. And at the top, it says, join the conversation, and in a few days, there will be a section of our website that says discussion. There's a tab, and I would love it if my talk tonight or any of our work stirs ideas in you. You'd like to share either differences or additional points that build on what we're saying, or whatever you'd like to share with us. That's how you find the place. And I will be adding there stories that amplify my message in EcoMind. So here I go. I'm going to ask you three questions to begin. First of all, are you worried? Are you worried about the state of our planet? Yes. Second, do you feel that you have personal power to do something about the direction we're headed? Can you raise your hands? On the yes, anyone who does feel they do. Wonderful. And then my third question is, do you have a personal hypothesis? Do you have a working theory about how we got into this shape and how we can get out? I got a maybe. Okay. So, I'll just say flat out that in some sense my new book, EcoMind, is my working hypothesis. And believe me, it's always that. It's an hypothesis for you, for me to continue to test out against reality. So I'm very eager for your input. But I'd like to start my talk with this, drawing in the words of D. Hock, who was the founder of Visa, and he once wrote, "It is far too late, and things are far too bad for pessimism." And so, in a way, EcoMind is sort of about that. But the second question I asked about how powerful you feel, and certainly some of you do feel personally empowered to help make this course change. But this is really all important, and this is right to the heart of EcoMind, which is ultimately about power. Because here's my starting thesis, is that, okay, my strong sense is that what we really have to worry about is not the climate crisis, the deepening poverty and hunger in the world, et cetera, et cetera. What we really have to worry about is our feeling of powerlessness to affect these problems. And the reason that I say that is because I argue that actually solutions are known, or they're just around the corner. And I think that there's a pretty good argument that solutions are known. Whether you start with Amory Levin's work on the energy crisis and how he shows us that with a lot less money, a small fraction of the money we're spending in Iraq and Afghanistan, over several decades we could be off of fossil fuels in most ways. Or if you take example today of Costa Rica, 95% now of its electricity from renewables, and Denmark just recently released its proposal for how it will move completely off both fossil fuel and nuclear by mid-century. I certainly think we know solutions to the hunger crisis. I mean, we are producing per person about 30% more food for each of us than when I was sitting over there in the UC Berkeley Library writing Diet for a Small Planet. And yes, we know that our current way of producing food increasingly is a very destructive one, but we also know how to get it right. Just one of the many studies that's come out over the last decade or so, a University of Michigan study showed that if we moved toward organic, toward agroecology worldwide, we could actually increase food production by about 50%. We could certainly meet the needs of today's population, and that predicted over the next decades. So we know how to do that too. And poverty, yes, the gap between rich and poor is widening throughout the world, but we know how to solve poverty. After all, in my lifetime, in the 1960s, we cut the U.S. poverty rate in half. And Brazil, which is a highly unequal society, over 6 years cut their poverty rate, six recent years, by 25%. And by some measurements, it could be even much higher than that. So I'm saying that none of this is within our reach. None of this, these great, great problems of the world are without solutions that are pretty much right in front of us. So that's why I call myself not an optimist, not a pessimist, but a possibilist, that it's possible that we can make this turn. So then the question is, okay, if solutions are known or right around the corner, then what could be powerful enough to have us together creating a world that none of us as individuals would choose, because nobody chooses, yes, I'm getting up this morning to heat the planet. Yes, I'm getting up this morning to make sure another child dies of hunger. So what could be powerful enough? And so my working hypothesis in EcoMind is that given the makeup of our species, there is only one thing that powerful. And that is that we humans are creatures of the mind. We see the world according to the mental maps we hold, the filters through which we see, and we literally cannot see what is not within that filter. This is now increasingly is shown, but I'll give you a very homey example. Okay, a couple of Thanksgivings ago, I was getting up in the morning. I got up in the morning knowing that 33 people were coming for Thanksgiving dinner in the afternoon, so I better get busy making my favorite root vegetable dish. So I went into the kitchen to look for my Dutch oven, nice red pot, and I was going to cook my root vegetables, but I couldn't find it. And I went to the basement, I went to the cupboards, and I finally gave up. I was very frustrated. About an hour later, I turned around, and there it was. Except that It had a plant in it. So my mental map was looking for a kitchen item. So I could not see. Remember, it's red. It's very obvious. I didn't see it because I'd put an amaryllis plant in it. So the power of our mental map, what does that mean? It means that we absorb this idea that seeing is believing, but actually, for our species, believing is seeing. It's we see according to our belief system. Now, that's neither here nor there in one way, but it's everything in another way. In other words, if our mental map is life-serving, great. But my thesis is that you and I are alive this extraordinary moment in our species evolution where the dominant prevailing mental map is profoundly, it's perversely malaligned with our own nature and with wider nature. So I'm saying that we are at a point where the prevailing mental map, what I've now called the scarcity mind, is trapping us so that we cannot see, and we end up actually creating exactly what we say we're trying to escape. So that really is the thesis. It's so malaligned with who we are that I claim, and I can't prove, but I claim in this book, that the global epidemic of depression is directly related to this. That our basic needs are so denied, and I'm going to get into that in a moment, what is the nature of human beings, that now suicides take 50% more lives than homicides. So, okay, what is the dominant map then that is keeping us creating a world that we as individuals would not choose? I call it the scarcity mind. It sees through this lens that you and I are all separate from one another, we're separate from nature, in a world where there's not enough of anything. There's not enough goods, goodness. There's not enough stuff in the world, whether it's energy or food or parking places. We just had some difficulties confirming that thesis. So the premise is not enough of anything, goods or goodness, because the dominant view, what I call the scarcity mind, says that, in fact, if you peel away the fluff from human nature, we can be reduced to simply we are materialistic, competitive, and selfish. So from that premise, what happens? We believe that we're incapable of coming together and deliberating over what all of us would want to further the survival of all of us. And instead, we so doubt ourselves from this premise of lack, and we're so afraid that we believe we have to turn over our fate, preferably to something beyond human control, something that operates on its own without us. And we've been told, certainly over the last generation, over since the 1980s in particular, that we have landed on it. We found it. It's called the magic of the market. It works on its own. This infallible law, the market, the more that we turn over everything to it, and if you were listening to the radio this morning, well, I guess that was in Boston. But anyway, that now even so much of our war making is now transferred over to independent contractors, that even the vetting, the security checks for people working for these contractors doing our war making are private. Even our character, I mean, you know, the vetters are privatized. Anyway, we're so distrusting that we're able to come together to do that thing called democracy. So my point is simply that then what happens is that there are many ways to organize a market, as we've used markets ever since we started exchanging things with one another. That's a market. But we hit upon this peculiar rule, the peculiar idea that a market could work driven by essentially one rule, highest return to existing wealth. And so you have wealth accruing to wealth accruing to wealth in our country until you reach the point that by 2005, Citigroup, not me, Citigroup named it. We've arrived at plutonomy, economy controlled by the rich. And so they advise their investors, you can read it online in the memo written in 2005 by the Citigroup researchers, to bet on the wealthy, to invest your money in toys for them. So we end up then with an inequality in this country today that is worse than India. Now that then infuses the political process to the degree that we now have 24 lobbyists for every single person that we send to Washington to represent us there. Now, this is a very shorthand way of explaining how we start out with a premise of lack, fear, lack of goods, lack of goodness. We turn over our fate to supposedly infallible force that concentrates wealth, and then what happens? We end up creating the very scarcity for the majority that we say was the premise to begin with. So the premise has suddenly been confirmed by our experience. And we say, see, I told you, human beings, look at those Wall Street people. They're all greedy. See, that's human nature. That's the way it is. So my point is then that this premise of lack of good, the goodness, this scarcity mind, as long as we're seeing through it, we're trapped. We ultimately are powerless because we feel that we have to give over our fate to others. What is the alternative? The alternative is emerging around the world, including the villages that Anna and I visited that were just around the path from that picture, around the world who aren't so ensnared in the scarcity mind. And what is emerging is what I love to call eco-mind. It is evidence-based. It is based, yes, by looking at the nature of nature itself. It tells us that rather than lack and separateness, we are all connected moment to moment in continuous change, so that our reality is co-created moment to moment. We learn from those studying biological systems, such as one of my heroes, Dennis Nobel, at Oxford, who writes in his beautiful little book called The Music of Life, which I highly recommend. He says that in biological systems, there are no privileged components telling the rest what to do. There's rather a form of democracy involving every element at all levels. The shape of life, he writes, emerges through the interaction of all components of the system with each other. So separateness is an illusion. Nothing is fixed or finished. Those notions are also fanciful. Everything is mutually created moment to moment. And so my friend and physicist in Germany just says it very simply. He said, Frankie, in biological systems, there are no parts. There are only participants. So rather than feeling separate and feeling powerless, suddenly, if we cultivate the eco-mind, we see that choices moment to moment to moment are shaping the reality of all other components in the system. And the most stunning realization of an eco-mind is, for me, simply that we can move from the premise of lack to the premise of possibility. And that's just why I don't call myself an optimist nor a pessimist. I call myself a dyed-in-the-wool possibilist. Now, the problem is that our culture is constantly reinforcing the scarcity mind, constantly the messaging. And so what I do in EcoMind is I take seven what I call thought traps, seven messages that are in our culture, some of them about the environment, some of them about human nature, some about our relationship to rules and regulations. And I take these and then look at them from an eco-mind and try to suggest a reframe that can spring us free from the scarcity mind so that we can move into the kind of hope that is grounded in action and evidence. So my point is that tonight I can't go through all three, but I'll just mention all seven of these. I'll just mention three to give you an idea of what I'm getting at here. So I want to go a little bit more into what I think of as one of the primary thought traps, and that is what I said earlier, that human beings are basically selfish, materialistic, and competitive. That's who we are. And gosh, it may not be pretty, but it got us to the top of the species pack, you know. Well, actually, what anthropology and new breakthroughs in archaeology, they're showing us is that We evolved over 90% of our evolution in tightly knit tribes that were highly egalitarian, where food sharing was the norm. And in that circumstance, and I've learned a lot in this regard from the Berkeley professor of anthropology, Sarah Blaffer Hardy, H-R-D-Y, who I highly recommend you read. But we evolved in such a way that now it should be no surprise that when the neuroscientists look at us, looking at our brains when we're doing certain activities, that it turns out that they're discovering that, for example, cooperation. When they look at us, when we're competing and when we're cooperating and compare, they find that when we cooperate with one another, that the pleasure centers of our brains are so stimulated, it's like equivalent to eating chocolate. It's that pleasurable. So we evolved that way. It's showing up more and more. And empathy, it turns out, when psychologists give us these experiments, they gave one group a bunch of money to spend on themselves for a day and the other group a bunch of money to spend on somebody else. And guess who ended up happier? So again, that we were so closely intertwined with one another, as we now learn from Ecology is All Life, that we are happier if we are actually making others happy. It turns out we can't really separate those, and I'll come to that in a moment. So we can go through a whole list of things. The human need for efficacy. We couldn't have made it to this point if we were basically couch potatoes and whiners, that we are doers. We need to, as Eric Fromm, the philosopher, wrote, he said, let's flip the Descartes idea of I think, therefore I am. Much more accurate to describe our species is I am because I affect. So I could go through an even longer list of capacities, of deep needs in our species that are exactly what we need right now, including not just cooperation, but shared intentionality is a term that I find so useful from the psychologist Tomasello talks about that. Another distinct piece of our human makeup is that we, compared to other primates, and that we are a species that creates plans together and loves to carry them out together, shared intentionality. So we have what it takes. So the question is, if we're so great, then how do we get into this mess? How did we do it? So EcoMind, if I can so humbly suggest, gives us a way of answering that question. Now, it's very simple. It's very obvious that if we see like an ecosystem, if we think like an ecosystem, we begin to recognize that, of course, every organism, including this one, each of us, is shaped by our environment. So, as I've just quoted Dennis Nobel as pointing out, that we're shaped, all components of the system are shaped by all others. So we have to recognize that, yes, we have these very pro-social qualities. At the very same time, we can grow up as a species and recognize that in the wrong environment, now it's been shown, whether it be the Holocaust or other genocides, whether it be the Stanford prison experiment, where young people tested normal were put into a mock prison setting, an experiment that was supposed to last 2 weeks had to stop in 6 days because these young people who'd been put into roles as guards and prisoners were so brutalizing one another that Philip Zimbardo, who carried out that study, the psychologist, he had to stop it in 6 days because they were so brutalizing one another. He said not too long ago that the behavior was eerily similar to what we saw in those images from Abu Ghraib. So basically what we can to free ourselves from the sense of powerlessness that we are in if we believe that we are just essentially these selfish little shoppers, as I think of it, and we can adopt a lens of the eco-mind and see that we are very much what our environment pulls out of us. That not the few sadists at the top, they were not the ones who we can blame the Holocaust, for example. Ordinary people participated fully in that horror. So what I'm saying is that we have this incredibly pro-social dimension, very many aspects of it, and yet in the wrong circumstances, most of us, not a few of us, can behave with ultimate cruelty, barbarity. And we don't know whether we're one of those until we're put to the test. So now we know what to do, right? We can look for precisely what are the conditions that bring out the worst in us, and then flip them. And so I propose at least three conditions proven to bring out the very worst in us. They are the concentration of power. They are secrecy, like we saw on Wall Street, where the byword was IBG, YBG. I'll be gone, you'll be gone, meaning I can get out of here after I've created these toxic mortgage system, and I can be out of here with my millions before anyone knows what I'm up to. So secrecy, yes, brings out the worst in us, and also the blame game, the blaming the other, it's his fault, it's her fault, and which we see in such extreme forms now with the Tea Party and others. So this then begins this looking at ourselves like organisms in an ecosystem that we are creating. We can then say, okay, we know what to do. We can flip each of those conditions. And this is what I'm saying is happening. All over the world, they may not use my language at all or my framework, but what is emerging is what I'm calling living democracy. And it is the opposite of the, and I'm going to return to this in a moment, the opposite of the something done to us or for us kind of idea of democracy. It's one that continually disperses power, creates transparency in human relationships, and ends the blame game by all of us stepping up to be co-creators of power in which we are holding ourselves accountable as well. So that is one example in the work I'm doing in EcoMind, to take a thought trap that human beings are selfish and greedy and materialistic and try to transform that into what I call a thought leap, in which we can take what is true in that, but learn from it to know what we need to do to create the world we want. A second example of a thought trap in EcoMind is an environmental message that we hear often, that we've hit the limits of a finite planet. You know, we've just filled up the planet. And I'm saying that that is a thought trap, because it scares the bejeebies out of us. It can also make us feel that somehow the problem is just that things are too much. It's really the planet's the problem. The planet's too stingy. It doesn't have enough. We've hit up against its fragility. Rather than focusing us on the systematic destruction and waste which we ourselves are creating. So the hitting the limits, let me just challenge this idea for a moment in this way. Hitting the limits is a kind of absurd notion if you just let absorb this one fact, that every day the sun supplies the earth with 15,000 times a dose of energy that we're currently using in fossil fuel. 15,000 times. And the hitting the limits makes no sense at all, once we recognize that we're wasting more energy than we're using, and we're wasting almost as much food as we're eating. In this country, we waste over 40% of our food. It's grown by about 50% the waste since I wrote Diet for a Small Planet in the early 70s. And so my point is that this hit the limits idea sends the message that of the scarcity, and we've got it, but it's also telling us if we just cut back, that we'd be okay. But think about that. If in the U.S. we cut back from 30 billion plastic bottles to 15 billion plastic bottles, would that solve the problem? We now have a plastic soup in the Pacific Ocean the size of states of Texas. Well, we might get it back to one state of Texas, but that's not still what nature can that is aligned with what natural regeneration. So my point here is that the thought leap is that we can let go of this idea of hitting the limits, this quantitative sense that takes our attention away from the systemic creation of waste and destruction, and shift to what I like to call the frame of alignment, where we recognize that as we align with nature's rules, there is more than enough for all of us, more than enough, that there is there's enough for all of us to thrive well. And so that immediately shifts the attention away just from cutting back to balancing and creating cycles, particularly the carbon cycle, that is restorative. In other words, if we think just about cutting, we think of cutting fossil fuels, which of course we need to do. But we forget that just as important also is increasing the absorption of carbon. If we shift to alignment, we start to see in cycles. And we prioritize agriculture. We prioritize the world's small farmers who are the new climate heroes because they have the potential. Just in agroforestry alone, some experts in this field, that's the combination of trees and agriculture, that just in agroforestry alone, that about a third of the carbon that we need to, the extra carbon that we need to get rid of, that we're loading down and overloading our systems with, can be dealt with. In other words, we prioritize the entire, looking at the entire cycle of carbon in our system. A frame of alignment also we begin to see, wait a minute, in nature, every product is a food for something else so that we can begin to let go of the whole notion of waste. I was just at Omega Institute and they told me never to use the term wastewater again because no water has to be wastewater. And there, this is in upstate New York, 25,000 gallons a day, it's quite a big campus, 25,000 gallons a day of all the water used from everything from toilets to the kitchen, etc., goes through John Todd Eco Machine, which includes plants and microorganisms, and in 36 hours, it's ready to return to the aquifer clean. So we shift then from a notion of limits to a notion of alignment, and we begin to see possibility. We get curious. We get curious, and I think this is the key for me of the eco mind. It's sort of because we're always thinking in connections, then we can be like the two-year-old and say, oh, how does that connect to that? And why is that? And why is that? It stimulates our imagination rather than thinking, oh, we know, we've just done too much. We've hit the limits and we just filled up the planet. Rather, we think in connections and why the waste and destruction. And we begin to get curious about one rule economics. Why the waste and destruction? We begin to see that, and many great thinkers are pointing this out to us, Amory Lovin certainly, who will be here, is one of them, as showing us how, indeed, that the full consequences of what we're doing aren't incorporated into the rules that we're creating. And therefore, that why is that? Then we can ask why again, and we can go back to what I was pointing out earlier, that this one rule economy then creates such concentration of wealth that infuses our political system so that we have what I've come to call privately held government. And we've been warned by many great people about this, but no one better than Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who in 1938 said, quote, to a joint session of Congress, imagine President saying, the liberty of democracy is not safe if a people tolerate the growth of private power to the point that it is stronger than the democratic state itself. That, in its essence, is fascism. That was Franklin Roosevelt in April of 1938. So I'm saying that we get curious. We want to ask why. We want to peel away the layers and go down to what is the causal pattern and what, therefore, is the solution. So I want to move quickly to the last thought trap in EcoMind is called It's Too Late. And basically what I'm saying there is that yes, it is too late to avoid great suffering that we could have avoided if we'd made this turn that I'm talking about much sooner. But it's not too late for life. Life loves life. Life strives for life. And I feel strongly that the evidence is about our species, that it's not a great challenge like climate change and global hunger worsening that really depress us and do us in. What really puts us down is a feeling of futility, a feeling there's nothing that we can do that really gets to the root of the problem. And that's where we really need to be focusing, that because we are doers. And I remember reading about the miners in the trapped in the mine, the 33 miners in Chile who were trapped. And they all, but one, suffered post-traumatic stress syndrome. I understand one did not. And the one who did not was the one who was active and helping to organize things. And he did not suffer the same harm to his psyche. We are doers. So my suggestion is that the lesson, as we begin to shift toward this thinking like an ecosystem, is to begin to think of democracy in the very same way, as an ecology of democracy, not as a set system, but a set of system values that permeates everything. So that whether it's the classroom, whether it's economics, so that, for example, what is the form of economics that meets these conditions to bring out the best in human beings instead of the worst? Well, it's the dispersion of power, transparency, and mutual accountability, which is all what, for example, cooperatives are all about. Now, if you think cooperatives are some quaint thing from the, I don't know, prior era, my 60s era, you're very wrong, because it turns out that there are likely more people today who are members of co-ops in the world than who own shares in publicly traded companies. And there's a burst now of food co-ops being created in this country. And in India, where all we hear about are call centers, that's all we know about, actually, that women cooperatives in India created more jobs than, many more jobs than the high-tech sector. So in economic life, there is a variant of this ecology of democracy that is embodying the conditions that bring out the best in us. And what about political life? That seems like the hardest nut to crack in many ways, this privately held government. But we know how to do that too. And I love to embody that answer in one person. A woman who, you can see the film on smallplanet.org. Her name is Deb Simpson. My son Anthony made a film about her. She's a Mainer, a resident of Maine, who was a waitress and a single mom in the year 2000. And her friends saw great leadership in her, and they encouraged her to run for office. And she said, what are you talking about? I can't run for office. I don't have any money. And they said, Deb, we've got public financing in Maine, voluntary public financing. And she ran. She was elected. She's on the Natural Resources Committee now. And she was there to help pass a law, because over 80% of the legislators in Maine have run without corporate money. They were able to stand up to an onslaught of corporate advertising and pass a producer responsibility law that has kept 1 pound of lead out of the state of Maine for every single person in Maine. So that is an example. And now this approach, voluntary public financing, which the Supreme Court has allowed to proceed, voluntary public financing, there is a law modeled on Maine's example that is now in both houses of Congress with, I believe, about 70 co-sponsors in the House of Representatives. But let me jump to the end of my talk and get more personal, because hopefully you got an idea of my working hypothesis. But what does that mean for us personally? Because this is a very personal challenge to live in this time of so much suffering and decline. And so my byword, my little phrase, is what I'm trying to cultivate, is what I call bold humility. Bold humility. And the bold part is realizing that we evolved in tightly knit tribes in which we knew that separating from the pack was almost certain death. It was the scariest thing of all. But here we are with the hyper tribe heading right over Victoria Falls. And so separating from the tribe right now, it means life. So what happens? We've got to tell ourselves that something that is scary, scary, scary is actually life promoting. So it means that we also have to recognize that fear itself is in part an idea. It's an idea. And they're learning, the scientists, neuroscientists, are learning that our brains are actually plastic. They call it neuroplasticity, so that our thoughts really create the shape of the neural connections in our brains. And as we think about fear, just as we think about the eco mind versus the scarcity mind, actually changes our brains. So what if we thought of fear as in part an idea? Yes, it doesn't. We often think fear, if we feel it, in my case it's like this, that it's always meant to me, oh my God, you are in really in trouble. You are in, you know, you are in shaky ground. You're way, way, way over the edge, and you better stop or, you know, flee, fight, freeze. But once I began to realize fear as pure energy, which is in part what it is, and I learned from a great African teacher that Anne and I encountered on that same journey, I learned that, yes, fear is energy, that we can choose what we do with it. And so I do some cheesy gimmicks, like I used to say, oh, you wimp. But now with that pounding heart, I say, oh, inner applause. And sometimes it even works. But the point is that only as maybe that how we understand fear may be the most important choice that we can make with our lives. So what do we then need? I'm saying that human beings are good enough. We have these wonderful pro-social qualities. What we need is more backbone. What we need is more courage. And so one way, yes, is rethinking fear. Another one is thinking, again, back to the neuroscience, that they're discovering that there are neurons in our brain, so that when I'm doing this, there are mirror neurons that are doing, that are firing as if you were doing, moving your arms like I'm moving right now. So what that means is we can consciously choose to associate, to bring into our lives stories and people who will strengthen our backbone, who will encourage us to take risks, who are braver than we perhaps, and we will become more that way. We can be certain of it. And so, you know, people often associate me with eating a healthy diet. Just as important as a brain diet is a bringing stories of possibility. And now in EcoMind, I have a whole list of websites and newsletters that offer us stories of possibility. Because this is empowering who we bring into our lives. And a study at the University of Virginia had two groups at the foot of a hill, and one group, well, they all had heavy backpacks, but one group had friends by their side, the other group did not. And then they said, okay, how steep is that hill? And the group that had friend by the side judged this hill to be significantly less steep. So reaching out to others, connecting with others, to feel that we are in this together with people who will challenge us, certainly is a key part of how we build the backbone. But the humility part is equally important. And what I mean by that is that several years ago, after this journey where we, Anne and I, saw movements throughout the world that I would have given almost zero probability of success when I was her age. And yet they were happening. And suddenly I came home and I said, there's a new form of humility that's growing in me. Because I'm realizing that with an eco mind, although I didn't have that term then, it's not possible to know what's possible because things are in movement and so many things are interacting. And so if I can say, for example, the landless workers movement in Brazil, which when I was co-founding Food First with Joe Collins, we thought Brazil would be the last country in the world would ever have effective land reform. And now about 250,000 families have been settled on almost 35 million acres of land and creating agroecology and other good things and new schools. And I would never, no, not possible. Or when Gauri Mathai, who we met on that journey, she planted 7 trees on Earth Day in 1977. And would I have predicted, oh yeah, right, it's going to move into a movement of 40 million trees being planted. No. I would never have predicted that. Bold humility is to say it's you don't know. Or that growing up in Texas, would I have ever thought that in the 1990s the Texas utility companies would actually pull some citizens together and listen to their desires about the direction of energy production, and turn out that there was such wind energy investment in my home state of Texas, that today the U.S. is a world wind energy leader largely because of the investments by those utilities in Texas? No, I would never have predicted that. So my point is that with an eco mind, we have to get ready for surprises. So the combination of the sense of developing that backbone, recognizing that we're good enough, but maybe we have to learn more and more techniques to strengthen our capacity to step outside of the pack. And at the same time, we are developing this kind of humility where we can realize that it's simply not possible to know what's possible. And I will end with a poem by my favorite writer that we end Hope's Edge with, Denise Levertov, my favorite poet. We have only begun to love the earth. We have only begun to imagine this fullness of life. How can we tire of hope? So much is in bud. How can desire fail? We have only begun to imagine justice and mercy. We have only begun to envision how it might be to live as siblings with beast and flower, no longer as oppressor. We've only begun to know the power that is ours if we would join our solitudes in a communion of struggle. So much is unfolding that must complete its gesture. So much is in bud. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. You're listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. Our speaker is I was so mesmerized by your talk. Is Francis Moore LaPay, and I'm Kerry Curtis. Although I should admit that right now. So now's come time for audience questions. So I'm going to pass the mic around.
So your talk makes me think of all of the futuristic films that are coming out of Hollywood, all of them depicting, it would seem, a devastated Earth and a very raw and challenged populace. And I'm wondering if in your talks that you give around the country, if this ever comes up as a topic for discussion, because what you were saying about thought, about what we believe is what we manifest, I think of that so often when I see the films that are out there. I haven't seen anything that depicts another future for us.
Oh, I feel that is exactly the point that I'm making, that the power that has for our psyches is enormous, and that's why all anything that we can do to support the opposite, whether it be through film or some other mechanism, or just whatever stirs us to share that with others, then we're all educators in that sense. And earlier in today, we were in an event, and a question related came up, and also pushing back, to whether it be news reports that are simply giving us the negative. I mean, I was so struck last year when all we heard was famine in Niger. What we did not hear about, except there was a story about it in The Nation, but I think it's not widely known, that Niger, which is one of the poorest countries in the world, that they have re-greened 12.5 million acres, 200 million trees growing there that nurtured by the farmers, and 2.5 million people gaining food security through these efforts. And so this is the kind of story. There's a beautiful film called The Man Who Turned Back the Desert about country of Burkina Faso, not far, that tells about how he said, no, 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 when his neighbor started to flee because of the desertification of his area in Burkina Faso, he stayed there. He said, well, our ancestors knew how to do this. We can figure it out. And he did. He did. And now 500,000 acres have been regreened using other techniques, but traditional, and then teaching one another, and creating their own sort of extension services and that sort of thing. So we can all be storytellers, not to block out the negative at all, but to show the both and world today so that we can choose. Yes, please.
Thank you for your thoughts. I'm wondering, you've mentioned a few successful situations that you feel are in alignment. Are there any leaders or decision makers whose names we might recognize that you feel are practicing EcoMind? Or are there some that you've been able to reach?
Well, I think there's so many. Well, certainly Amory, you know, has come up tonight, Amory Lovins and Hunter Lovins. Also the work of the Zero Waste Institute in Europe. Gunter Pauli, P-A-U-L-I. One of the stories I wanted to tell is about the very simple approach of using... I was in... the mountains of Colombia in South America, and saw women who were very, very poor in the inner city who were using coffee grounds, you know, the coffee waste from coffee roasting to grow mushrooms, and then any waste in that, they were growing livestock. So Gunter Pauli is certainly someone who is very focused on this. The authors of Cradle to Cradle, that beautiful book, if you haven't read it, it's all about what I'm talking about. So there are just so many people in the World Future Council, which I'm a member of, worldfuturecouncil.org, the policy awards that we give out every year, example after example last year it was the food award was given to the city of Belo Horizonte that Anna and I visited on our journey, where they declared food a right of citizenship in the city that began helped form the Zero Hunger campaign of all of Brazil. So the leaders there in Brazil are certainly examples. I think there are just so many examples. Certainly the Sierra Club initiatives underway today, many of them are aligned. I'm sure I'm blanking out on my favorite ones, but... my book has a long resource section at the end, and also websites and e-newsletters, and there are many of my heroes.
Hi, Frankie. Thank you so much for your talk. I find you do challenge some of my own dispiritedness, which is helpful. And you provide such great examples of individual and community both resistance as well as building up of positive solutions and alternatives. I guess my question is, on the more macroeconomic and political level, where that dispiritedness comes from, you know, how do you view the sort of level of opportunity or hope to deal with the larger sort of corporate dominance over economics and politics, and not just the individual corporations that we love to hate, but the underlying capitalist system and market-driven system?
Well, I think it comes back to, and I hope I at least was beginning to touch on it, that it comes back to this lack of faith in democracy itself, and that lack of trust. We have no vision of democracy that really works. The dominant idea of democracy is a very frail duo of market plus voting. And we know we can have that in the Philippines or El Salvador or the U.S. or India, and yet the majority of people are living in misery. So that if that's our only idea of democracy, then we're bound to be pretty depressed at this point. So what I'm suggesting is that how do we stoke, and I couldn't do justice to it in this talk, but in the book I hopefully do a better job, but how do we stoke that confidence in democracy? One of the things that actually kind of drives me crazy with a lot of my wonderful allies in the world, the critique is very powerful, but then stopping short of really naming what I call privately held government, it's shorthand, and really naming the solution, which is we have to remove the power of money within our political system. There is no way to get there from here without that step. And yet, to get people talking about this Fair Elections Now, the legislation, you can go fairelectionsnow.org, and to weigh in on that, that, for example, the Disclose Act, which could go some distance anyway toward transparency, which was one of the conditions I said was essential, the Disclose Act would have required that post that horrific Supreme Court decision, which I refuse to call by its official name because it's an abomination, but the decision by the Supreme Court that said that, you know, let go with corporate money, let it go spring free, that the Disclose Act, which would require corporations to make public what they were spending on in campaigns, that failed by one vote in the Senate. My point is that all of us, whatever we're working on, you know, I say, look, you can have your favorite issue, but your second issue has to be about getting our democracy back, getting money out and getting our voices in and showing examples where it's possible. So I point out, for example, in EcoMind, that in Costa Rica, there is an exclusion that corporations can't, I'm sure it's not perfect, but to a much larger degree, Costa Rica is without that kind of corporate corruption of our political system. And they have universal health care now for almost 60 years. That means that their life expectancy, on one quarter of our income per person, they have a life expectancy that's almost exactly the same as the U.S. So really, I'm saying the EcoMind helps us dig to those causal patterns and to find the courage to say that, yes, we have to have real democracy to do this, and we cannot have the best democracy money can buy. Yes, please.
Yeah, in getting around this sort of hegemony of the market, I do a lot of work with what's called the public trust doctrine, where some things are so valuable for public use that you can't treat them like private property, like water and air and things like that. And it's already in our laws. And I was just wondering whether you saw a lot of future in this public trust doctrine.
I do, absolutely. Absolutely. That which is life itself, that which we, by definition, share, produced by the earth, this is... I think the retrieval of the commons and the whole idea of the commons, which got maligned, you know, about the time that Diet for a Small Planet came out, and the terrible impact of a great metaphor that Garrett Hardin had with the tragedy of the commons, which was so false. And now Eleanor Ostrom getting a Nobel Prize for totally refuting and showing, wait a minute, a commons work beautifully if we together create the rules and help enforce them. So that in India, for example, there are now 10 million people, 10 million families involved in forest management groups, in other words, protecting their commons, their common forest. And India is one of the few countries in the world where there's actually an increase in forest cover and the health of the forest is improving. And because it's on this very concept of, you know, the care for the commons. And we think about Costa Rica. Again, I use it a number of times because they have taken this approach of rewarding people for caring for it, what's held in common. But we see this also in Ecuador, where people have foregone a great benefit they could have had if Yasuni, I think it is, this great forests there were tapped for oil and have said, no, we will not allow this to happen. This is our common heritage. And they forewent the immediate benefit of something like $7 billion, and they are now, there's an international fund being created to give them some interest to keep that honor, to honor that commitment, that is. But I think it's a very powerful concept that is intuitively, I think, pretty commonsensical for people. I know that the dream of this individual market is everything is hard to explode. But on the other hand, when we think how it's been created so so strongly over such a short period of time. Certainly by example, by risk-taking, by showing another way of being that is less, that is actually more ease, less fear, that it can be very strongly appealing. So thank you. That's a great question.
We've come to the time in our program where we have time for just one last question.
I share the comments of many of the people in the audience. Thank you very much for these good comments.
Oh, I appreciate that.
Tonight in the Chronicle, they were talking about the debate tomorrow of the Republican candidates, and the headline is, Science Gets Tricky for GOP Candidates. It says, nearly all of the major Republican candidates disagree and in some cases outright mock the scientific research supporting climate change. Representative Michelle Bachmann called it manufactured science. It's not only that maybe here are a bunch of ignorant candidates, but they represent a strong constituency in this country that just don't believe there is a problem. And I think people react in crisis. If there's not a crisis, they usually, especially politicians, don't do anything. And maybe we need more fires in Texas or more droughts in Texas or floods in the Northeast or tornadoes or whatever, so that there's a crisis for people to react. So my question is, isn't one of the mind traps that people think everything's okay? We don't have to do anything. We can cut the EPA regulations and et cetera. No problem. Isn't that a mind trap?
Certainly, in some ways, it definitely is. My take on it, though, is that people are, when that kind of blindness, it is out of fear, because there is no alternative vision. There is no practical alternative way forward, and so therefore people want to close their eyes. And so I think more fear is not the solution. I think for us to be able to show there are pathways in which needs can be better met through caring for the commons, for example. And many, many stories that I tell in the book, and that you are, many of you are more aware than I, but they're not being told. And to continue to share those stories ourselves and insist that our corporate media, but push back, insist that these stories are told. So I don't think that fear at this point is going to get us there. I think there's a great deal of fear. And so I think that we need the sense of possibility. There is a way that is actually better, more life-serving, in which we are living with less stress and more sense of trust of our neighbors. That's, I think, what human beings will thrive and will be drawn toward. And I appreciate your comments very much.
Join me in thanking Frances Moore LaPay for her remarks this evening.
Thank you. Thank you.
And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, observing over a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.